Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Tuesday, January 24th. I'm Ray Graff. Have you ever delved into your family tree, done a little research? It can be maddening. It can be very frustrating. It can also be expensive if you want it to be less frustrating. Well, we have somebody here who might be able to help you do it in a cheaper way. Genealogist Tracy Scrabbit returns to answer your genealogy questions today. Tracy is an archives technician focusing on genealogy at the National Archives at Boston. You got a question? Give us a call. 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. You can also email voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Tracy Scrabbit and your genealogy calls coming up. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Once again, here to answer your genealogy questions is Tracy Scrabbit. Tracy makes a long trek to be on this show and is one of our favorite guests. She is an archives tech working at the National Archives at Boston. She holds a BA in art from the University of Hawaii, a master's in museum studies from the Johns Hopkins University, and a master of library science from Kent State University with a specialty in archives and special collections librarianship. Just a note here, Tracy is not appearing on this show as a representative of the National Archives or speaking in any official capacity. She's here to help you solve some of the mysteries of your family tree, or at least get you pointed in the right direction. If you have a question, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You may also email if you wish. Don't make it too long, two paragraphs. voxpop@wamc.org is the email address, and the number is 800-348-2551. Tracy Scrabbit, welcome back.
Oh, it's nice to be back.
Isn't Albany always lovely at this time of year?
Actually, it wasn't too bad. Today, yesterday, was very snowy.
Now, that's a qualified response. Well, politically done. Nice job. Last time you were here, it was fair season, and it was nice weather, and it's been lousy. How's the weather out in Boston?
It's actually not been too bad. We haven't had too bad weather. Most of the stuff, the storms, I live right on the coast, so we've been able to avoid most of that.
Okay. Well, it's great to have you back here. I was telling you in the green room prior to the show that every time you come here, I get excited. I said, you know what? This is the year I'm going to do my family tree. And I spent about 30 minutes before the show going to some of the sites, free and otherwise, and checking them out. And then I said, you know what? I am going to look at the newly released 1950. That's the most recent one, right?
The most recent.
So I went to that census, and I knew where my grandmother lived in Long Island because I'd been there many, many times. So I had her address. It took me a long time to find the enumeration district, and then I started looking at the pages of the census. Number one, handwriting, not a real big priority for those people taking the census in those days. And number two, there were a lot of them that just said, knocked on door, not there. How accurate do you think these things were?
I think it depended on the enumerator. It depended on how many times they could go back to the house. And it also depended on who it was that they spoke to when they got to the house. So, for example, if enumerator came to your house and you're like, oh, I'm Ray Graff, I'm the owner of the house, I know exactly who's living here, I know how old they are, you know, but you find a lot of times, for example, in rental properties, you'll see this in a lot of the older censuses. Someone will enumerate a boarding house, and they just speak to whoever comes to the door. And you might get names incorrect, ages incorrect, citizenship status incorrect, because there was no real fact checking. It was your job is to go to the house, get as much information as you can, and then go. Because really, for the enumerate, I think what the censuses were for really was not about making sure you got completely accurate information. It was about collating information that would tell you about how many people were living somewhere, and then helping you to establish whatever necessary social services were around at the time. So it was sort of like, you know, if we get 70% of the information correct, we're happy with, or whatever the percentage right. was. Like, they were not expecting 100% accuracy. And these enumerators were given huge districts, you know, blocks and blocks that they had to search, which is not so bad if you're like in rural Kansas and you have three people on your route. But if you're in New York City and your block is, you know, three apartment buildings with, say, 50 apartments per building, and you still have only a set number of, you know, a number of days to get all the information.
Right.
You just try to get as much as you can from whoever you can, unfortunately.
You know, I was thinking about that, and I was also thinking about the attractiveness of some of these services, paid and otherwise, that help you get to that point. Because when I went to the 1950 census and searched, really, when you search, you're not, in most cases, going to get the name. You get a bunch of pages, and you have to manually go through these photos of these pages and try to figure out, A, what the words say, because, the handwriting is not all that great in all these. In fact, I was looking for my mom's out in central New York. Couldn't even read anything the person wrote. I assume things are getting better in that regard. I think the last census, we typed it in on a computer, I believe.
Yeah, so I think it really comes down to how long have we had to index the results. So, you know, if you go back and you look at, say, the 1910, 1920, 1930 census, there's been a lot more time for people to go in and do what you're doing, which is read the pages and try to translate what they see on there.
Yeah.
Because the 1950 census was only released not even a year ago, it was in April of last year, that work is still being done. And so a lot of it is still, you do have to go in and do the work yourself. Because I know when we were doing, you know, as part of our project, our project team at the National Archives, we were going in and doing the enumeration districts, making sure that they were, you know, written properly so that our program could read them. When you go to our website to look for the districts, you know, and it was, what, a dozen people for over 250,000 enumeration districts, you know, and so it was. And then you have all the districts inside, you know, it's like inside each enumeration district, it's however many streets.
Right.
Because you have the boundaries inside. So it was, you know, it was almost a million records that we had to do. And that's just the enumeration district. That's not the actual
names
records.
Yeah.
So it's over time. It takes time to look. And every census, the enumeration districts are different. So if you know where the enumeration district is in 1940 or 1930, it's not going to be the same in 1950. So every census that comes out, you are having to relearn where that particular house that you're looking for is.
Do you enjoy your work?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, such detective work. And it's got to be trying on the old gray cells.
You know, but I think that's part of the challenge. I mean, you know, when you go to work for the National Archives, you know, and you take your oath of office, you know, like, you know, you are committing to making records accessible to the public. That's the job of the National Archives. And, you know, we used to have an unofficial motto, ready access to essential evidence, because that's what we preserve, the evidence of the government doing business. And part of it is understanding that the way that the public is going to interact with records is not the same as the way an agency would. An agency knows what all the codes mean. An agency knows, how do I find this in this box on this shelf? The government, the public doesn't know that. And so part of the job is trying to find ways to make it easier for the public to find the records that they're looking for, and to cut out a lot of the technical information. So, for example, like with, you know, with we were talking about this recently with, you know, like passenger lists. The, you know, our passenger lists for ships coming in, it stops us at the ship, the port, the date. The people was not a concern. The names of the people. The head count was important because the ship had to pay a duty fee. But the names of the people who were in that head count, that's not of importance to the government. So what you'll find is when companies like Ancestry or Family Search take those records, the digital copies of those records, they then do that extra step and add the names.
Which is a great service.
Which is a great service, absolutely. So that's on their side, but we try to find other ways of making records more accessible. So you might have a case that's really important, you know, like maybe like a really important civil rights case, like U.S. versus Joseph Sinque. That was the Amistad case, right? If you just look at that, that tells you nothing. So one of the ways that we can increase access is by saying, okay, let's write a good scope and content note that tells people why this case was important, who the people involved were. You know, like we're doing a lot of work on reparative description is the current focus of the agency, and it's about trying to highlight records which may be of value but are not properly described. So records from African American community, from the Japanese community, Pacific Islanders, Puerto Rican records.
And each one of those has their own specific levels of difficulty.
Yes.
All right, let's take a quick break. You know, the way you describe it, Tracy, it's very noble work what you guys do.
Well, that's why you take the oath, you know what I mean?
Let's take a quick break. 800-348-2551 is our number. It's Genealogy Today with Tracy Scrabbit. We'll be back with your calls and your emails coming up. Vox Pop on WAMC. It's Genealogy Today with Tracy Scrabbit. The number is 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Let's grab a couple of emails here, and then we'll hit the phones. This one is from Monel. Is there any way to get information about Russian relatives from the late 19th century?
Well, it depends on what sort of information you're looking for. So if you're looking for ways in which they moved or interacted with the United States, that's a possibility. You could look at passenger lists of where they may have come into the country. You can look at naturalization records, possibly if they naturalized. At the state level, you could look for vital records, so birth, death, marriage records for the area in which they live. In terms of foreign records, that's not something that we would have at the National Archives. You could try, like Ancestry, for example, is a really good resource. They are digitizing records from all over the world.
And that's a paid service.
It's a paid service, but almost all local libraries do have a subscription that you can use in the library.
Okay.
You don't have to pay for it if you can't afford it or you don't want to.
This one is from Henry from Albany. Thank you for the program today. I have two great grandfathers who came to the U.S. from Eastern Europe to work on the Erie Canal. But then they left and returned back to their home country. I'm not sure if there are written documents, but I assume some sort of work documents or some type of record had to be documented. First question, what is the likelihood that their presence in the U.S. was documented? Second question, if so, where do I go to search?
Okay, so I would say the same thing. I would say for movement in and out of the country, you could search for passenger lists coming in. The government at least did not tend to save lists of people going out, but if you can think of a country they may have gone to, they might have incoming lists.
You're at a governmental level, but
yeah, at the governmental level. So in terms of work level, I'm assuming the Erie Canal is the state.
I believe
structure.
It was state of New York. Yeah.
So what I would do is I would contact the New York State Archive, which is here in Albany, and ask them if they have any records of personnel. Like, I know at the government level, we do have, in St. Louis, we have a civilian personnel record center where the government does store information on its civilian workforce. We also have a military record center there. So I would check with Albany State to see if they kept any personnel records from the time of building the canal. And see if you can track them that way.
Cool. Now, by the way, just you made me think of this. Before the show, I popped a link on the page for today's show. I was at the archives.gov site, and they have a really nice, concise way for people to start their family tree search. And so I put that link on your website, and I was going through it, and there's a lot of resources there about how you can get started in your own personal search. Let's go to the phones. Kathleen is in Loudonville. Kathleen, you're on.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. I have an interesting mystery. My great-grandfather was born in Scotland in the 1800s. He came to New York when he was probably 1820. The next date I have is his marriage in Brooklyn. He lived in Brooklyn the rest of his life. He was a New York Harbor pilot. His family adored him. My grandmother and her sisters all just loved him, talked about him, proud of him. He died and is buried in Oakwood Cemetery in Brooklyn. And about 10 years ago, a niece called up and said, "Aunt Kathleen, I didn't know that great-grandfather Pearson fought in the Civil War." So I called the cemetery, and they said there was a group that researches people who were fought in the war who weren't recognized, and they put stones next to their gravestones. I talked to my mother and my two aunts who were part of the women who grew up worshiping him, and they said, absolutely not. So when I talked to the person who was with the organization, they said they were just trying to honor everybody, and they had somebody with his name and his birth date, and they said he did. And we all think he didn't. So how would I research this?
Okay. What do you think?
I don't hear anything.
You didn't hear? Oh, my gosh. Holy mackerel.
And I can't hear either.
All right. So why don't you turn your volume up on that? I thought we did this. Turn up a little bit. Can you hear it? Can you hear me?
Yeah, okay.
Okay. So, Kathleen, that was a long question, but let's try to do the Cliff Notes version and give it to Tracy again.
Okay. My great-grandfather was born in Scotland in the 1800s, came to New York about 20 years later, lived in Brooklyn his whole life, was a New York Harbor pilot, and is buried in Oakwood Cemetery in Brooklyn. About 10 years ago, a family member noticed that there is an additional stone put next to his big stone honoring his service in the Civil War, and they said he was at Gettysburg. His family of mostly women, his daughters and granddaughters, all worshipped him, and I talked to my mother and her two sisters, and they all, before they died, and they all said, absolutely not. They would have known. They would have been so proud of him. They would have known if he had fought in the Civil War.
Oh.
I have no idea how to pursue finding out if it's true or not.
Okay. Well, all Civil War service records would be at, if he served in the Union Army, would be at our Washington.
I'm assuming, because he was from New York.
Yep. So they would be at our Washington, D.C. facility. So okay. What you could do is you could conduct a name search. Give them the general area if you're not sure. But if you go on Ancestry, does have Civil War records also. All of those, most of those records are all digitized. So you could do a search on Ancestry to get started. You could also try a search at Fold 3.
Fold 3?
Yep, Fold. It's Fold and then the number 3. Fold 3.
What is that?
It's also run by Ancestry, but that's where they have sort of created a repository of all the military records that they're digitizing. So you can find like pension records, service records, widows' pensions records. But that would be my first thing, is to check Ancestry. But also, if you go to our website, which is archives.gov, on the top there's a link that says Visit Us. If you click on that and you go to the page for the National Archives at Washington, D.C., there's a contact email and actually an online form that you can fill out to ask for information. But you should be able to conduct a search. You can also check with the state archive as well, because I know that there were like state militias.
Oh, sure.
And so to see if maybe he might have served at the state level, or if the state
has... Well, they said he was at Gettysburg. At the sign, it said he was at Gettysburg.
Huh.
Yeah. But, well, I mean, there were a lot of people from a lot of states that were there. So there were either some were state militias and some were federal troops, or they were rolled into federal troops. So I would check both. I would check Ancestry, you know, or Family Search. I would check Fold 3, and then I would send an email to Washington, D.C. to ask, because they hold all of the Civil War records, but also check with the State Archive in case they have military records. I know, like I said, we don't hold any New York records. We have just New England records, but I know, for example, Connecticut went and made their own census of veterans from that war, whether you served in a Connecticut regiment or not. So New York might have something similar.
And Kathleen, just one caveat. I went to Ancestry today. It seems really good, and there is a free trial, but you got to watch it. I think, and based on the comments I've seen, if you're not careful and you don't do anything, that automatic subscription will kick in. So you want to be vigilant if you have no intention of paying.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Yes.
Thanks for the call. 800-348-2551. You were saying, Tracy.
Yeah, I was saying, you know, just make sure you can just make use of your local library.
Yeah.
Because the local library usually has a subscription to Ancestry that you can use.
Okay, let's go to out near Utica Way. Kelly's in Barnerville. Kelly, you're on.
Hi. I am trying to locate my late grandmother's birth father's name. She is from Ireland, and when she immigrated, she was 9 years old, and her mother, my great-grandmother, used her name for the kids to come over. The true birth father was not named on the immigration records. And I wondered if there was a way to find that out through any New York adoption type records here, because when she moved here, my great-grandmother remarried and my grandmother then became a MacGuffin, which we know all about. But I was trying to find that link, the birth father, because we're trying to get a dual citizenship in Ireland, and that is the missing link.
Ah.
Well, I think in terms of birth records, you would need to check with the Albany State Archive, find out where they keep their probate records, which are their family court records, to see where they would store adoption records if they exist. Depending on the time period, it may not have been an official adoption, but I would go ahead and check with them to see if any records exist.
The Albany probate records?
Yeah, so the State Archive, and ask them where their probate or their adoption records would be held, and find out what the rules are on what is actually available, because there are many states where adoption records are closed and you may not be able to see them if the records exist. But depending on the time period, much like name changes, there may not have been anything that was official beyond just the people getting married and the spouse saying, okay, this is now my child. There may not have been an official adoption.
Oh, okay.
The other thing to consider is to potentially look for her birth certificate in Ireland. Depending, I do know generally if the birth, if the people were not married, the father tended not to be listed on the birth record, and that's how you can know that they were not married. Mm-hmm. Or if it was, you know, an adulterous thing, they tend not to list the father. They will list the mother, of course. But you could check Irish records. A lot of the ancestry has a lot of those as well, to see if to see if you can find a birth record on that side. You can also, depending on the time period, if they did not do official birth certificates, you may want to check church records for the town where they came from, because a lot of people might have recorded a like a birth or a christening at their at their local church.
All right, Kelly, thanks a lot for the call. Tracy Scrabbit joins us today. It's Genealogy on Vox Pop. The number is 800-348-2551. We'll go to Schenectady. Bob, you're on.
Hi, yes, this is Bob. I have a question. I have the genealogy and the family tree for my mother's side of the family. My father's, I can't find much of anything. His parents are actually from Canada. The mother's from Sault Ste. Marie. The father's from Montreal, and the farthest back I can go is about 1910 when they owned property in Clifton Park. And it's the same thing. I mean, I did that on my own, and it's the same information I get whenever I go to Ancestry. Ancestry doesn't go back any further than that either. So I don't know what to do. And I did it. My first cousin and I did genetic testing, and we're supposed to be half French, and there was no French listed on any of the genetic tests that we did. But my father and, you know, his father, they had French names. His mother had a French name, last name. And I'm wondering, maybe they came from Normandy, which there were a lot of Celtic people there that had French names, but they didn't have any French blood. So I don't know. I don't know how to handle this. I'd like to go back and see, you know, exactly when they came into Canada, if that's actually where they came in, or whatever information I can get.
Well, I would say Ancestry and Family Search, they're great resources, but they only can show you what's been given to them to digitize. So if, for example, maybe there are records that are in Canada for your relatives, but if whatever archive that exists there that has those records has not made them available, you won't be able to see them. So what I always tell people is that the digital records are only a starting point. So what I would say is look at what archives in the, you know, that some of your family may have come through Montreal. So check to see if there is a province archive for Montreal. Check the Canadian, they have a country archive. See if you can get information about where you can find information on people who were Canadian citizens. In the same way that, you know, the National Archives here, we have records of people within the states. Every country has a country archive. It's just about trying to figure out where the record is housed. So I would say just Google and see if Montreal has an archive. You know, just reach out to the provinces where you think your people might have lived, and also the Canadian National Archive, and say, hey, you know, a lot of the times the websites will have information about genealogy, and they'll let you know where to start looking if you're looking for relatives as well.
Bob, thanks a lot. Do you people at the archives have any kind of relationship with other country archivists?
Generally not, unless, because all of our records are separate. So, I mean, I think back in World War II, when the Allies captured German records, there was some kind of discussion about, you know, who should get these records? You know, who should, you know, is it whoever captured them?
Right.
Should they go back to whoever? So there were some discussions, but generally speaking, the records end where the country border is. So, for example, one of the really large ports for people to come in from Canada was St. Albans, Vermont. St. Albans is a train station. So there was a lot of train stations. And so our records are people on this side of St. Albans. But you go to, I'm not sure what province it is on the Canadian side, but you go to that side and they have all of the people coming in on that side. So so you could, you'd have to look in both places to see the information, but we tend not to intermix or to share unless it does happen that there is a record that could belong in more than one place.
Gotcha. Tracy Scrabbit is our guest. We'll take a quick break. It's Genealogy Today. Let me give the email address again. voxpop@wamc.org. And the phone number is 800-348-2551. We'll check the email bag in a moment. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you. It's Genealogy Today. Tracy Scrabbit is here. Tracy is an archives technician working at the National Archives at Boston. And just a note, she is not appearing on this program as a representative of the National Archives or speaking in an official capacity. She does this because she likes to help. And I'll tell you, we're very lucky to have her make the trip a couple times a year. A couple of emails here, Tracy, and then we'll go on back to the phones. This is from Steve. Is it still true that there is more information offline than there is available online? Are the National Archive buildings, are there National Archive buildings within the Hudson Valley with information available to the public for family tree info? And that's from Steve.
Well, I think absolutely. I mean, we have one of the smaller units, and we still have about 44,000 cubic feet of records, most of which are not digitized. You know, it's, you can only, I think most of our units have records that are not digitized, and it's an ongoing, you know, it's an ongoing process to digitize as much as we can. In terms of the National Archives presence in New York, the National Archives New York is in Manhattan.
Right. Okay. And probably not in the Hudson Valley. There are no ancillary units north.
No, there are none.
This is from JP. My maternal grandfather was born in 1910 in Staten Island, and there was no father listed on his birth certificate. He was what they used to call illegitimate. It has been a mystery all these years. My maternal grandmother just made up a last name for him and said that the father had died. My grandfather died in the 70s. But I would love to figure out who his father was. Any chance I could ever trace that? And that's from JP.
I think if it's not on the birth certificate, I think the only chance would be possibly if the birth was recorded in a family record, like a family Bible, or in a church record. If they were christened, the church might have asked, do you have a father's name to pull down? But it may not be possible, especially because it was such a shameful thing. You know, a lot of times people would go out of their way to hide that or to avoid it.
So it may be possible, but it's a lot of detective work,
it's
and you got to get lucky. This is a long email. Oh my heavens! This is a long email. This is from Florence. I'm very lucky because I have over 1,000 pages of family story written by my mother in the 70s. I use it as a framework to find sources for my family tree on Ancestry, where she notes that a relative was born the same year as she was, 1906. I can look for the name and the date and verify the information in documents. It's like working on a jigsaw puzzle. I'm in my 70s, so I knew many of my relatives, or because I have my mother's knowledge and have found verifiable source material, I can make connections. However, I'm finding that since not everyone has this good fortune, they're using sources that seem like they might be correct but are not. How do I let people know this without sounding like a know-it-all? I've tried to gently point out the errors and offered the correct sources, but no one seems willing to make the changes, and then others pick up on the wrong connections, and it's like a game of telephone where it just gets farther and farther from reality. or maybe I should just leave it alone and make sure my own sources are correct and hope for the best. Okay, so I don't see a question there, but go ahead.
Well, I think you find that a lot, right? So with, for example, you might be looking for a Ray Graff, and you go, oh, there's this Ray Graff, and he's from Floral Park. That must be the guy, but it's actually the Ray Graff from Hempstead.
You're right.
If you're not from Hempstead, my apologies.
Well, I'm not.
But you know what I mean? Like, yes. A lot of times, you know, people will make mistakes because they don't actually understand how genealogy works or how naming conventions work.
Yeah.
You think the name of your ancestor is unique, but if you look into it, there could be a dozen people with the same name. But people don't think about that because names are much more unique now. So what I tend to tell people is, like, what we do is we put together information packets and we go, hey, this is what you're looking for. This is how, you know, how it works. So I might suggest doing something like that. Like, hey, do you have friends? You know, you can say, hey, you know, I was thinking about, you know, maybe doing a workshop, you know, or whatever. And I have this information that I've been putting together to help people out because I have, you know, people ask questions. Do you want the information? And then they can take it or they can't. But at the end of the day, you can't force someone to do it your way. They're either going to figure out that it's correct or they're not.
Yeah.
You can offer suggestions. But if you, you know, if you try to, you know, frame it as something that's educational or helpful rather than you're doing this wrong.
See, I don't think you have that problem. So. You'll just say it like it is. This is from Barbara at Ulster County. Hello, Tracy. Hi. Ray, would you have a suggestion how to find a genealogist to do research for me in a foreign country, specifically Poland? I know you're a U.S. archives person, but thought you might have some idea. And that's from Barbara in Ulster County.
Well, I think you could start with, actually, on our website. I don't know the exact address. But if you Google NARA professional genealogists, we have a website where people can register. They don't work for the National Archives, but they are people who consider themselves professional genealogists, and they will list in there what their specialty is, whether it's military records or genealogy or whatever. So you could start there. The other thing I would suggest is checking to see if there are any local Polish American clubs.
Oh, good idea.
In your area.
Yeah.
And see if they have anyone that they know who is good at searching records. That would be something else. The other thing would be to reach out to an archive in Poland. You know, it's in the same way that we have a list of people who have registered saying that they're good with working with our records. They might have something as well, like a list of people who have registered, or they may be able to point you in the direction of someone who could work with their records. I think a lot of people get afraid because they assume that if it's a record from a foreign country, that they won't be able to communicate. But I tend to find that the vast majority of places where you think people don't speak English, they actually do. And if they don't, there's always Google Translate. I use that a lot.
Do you really?
When I get foreign requests, and it's like, I don't speak Japanese, I don't speak Russian, I don't speak, you know, Ukrainian, but I can put it in Google Translate and try to get an approximation of what the person's looking for.
I like to use that when I want to swear at my relatives in a foreign tongue. It's very nice. All right, let's go back to the phones. Julia in Longmeadow, you're on.
This has been a great program, and I cannot wait to replay it for my family later tonight.
Oh, thank you.
But I wanted to learn if I wanted to tell my kids why, how they could become an archivist like Tracy.
Well, there's a couple of different ways. We have the most normal path would be to get a degree in it. There are bachelor's degrees in library science, but I that's more rare. You can get a master's degree in library science. There are schools all over the country who do that. For example, I went to Kent State. They have a focus on library science. I know San Jose State, there's a numbers where they have a library science degree where the focus is on archives. You can also go into it from a public history standpoint. So a lot of my, quite a number of my colleagues who work with me, they went to Boston University in their public archives and public history program, and that's also a master's degree. But I think you can also, you know, do it by learning. I mean, if you want to do it professionally, yes, you're going to need a degree. But there are also people who study on their own. The Society of American Archivists has a lot of training that you can do. They have books and stuff. And then if you learn enough, you can actually get a certificate called Certified Archivist through the through the Society of Archival Professionals, but it's a professional certificate that you can also test, and that shows that you've
demonstrated your aptitude and everything else. Yeah. Julia, you want to follow up?
Thank you so much. This is it's really been a fascinating Vox. Thanks so much.
Hey, Julia, thank you for the call. And by the way, Tracy, that's the first time anyone ever said that about an edition of Vox Pop. So congratulations. It was fascinating today. Chris in Rexford. Chris, you're on.
Hello. My father, born in 1919, and his aunt, born around the turn of the century at that point, 1900, had started a genealogy record. My dad put it into a digital form and in hard copy. It amounts to about 25 binders, very well organized with pictures of the people, interesting facts if he found it, art news articles, but also a true lineage is in there. I want to know what's the best way to preserve that. I know that the Mormons are interested, Library of Congress. I'm in the process of scanning those documents, at least to get them into a digital format, but that's not necessarily the best way to go about it. So if you have any suggestions on that, that would be appreciated.
I think
about 250 years back in to about 1650 is where the beginning of it is.
Well, I think in terms of preservation, it's really going to be up to you. So some people will say, okay, we'll do it digitally. It'll be on CDs. When the technology changes, we'll have to transfer. Some people will say, we'll do it, use cloud storage. But if the cloud storage goes down, that's an issue. What I would suggest, if you're looking for a place to preserve it for you, would be to look at, for example, I always suggest the New England Historical Genealogical Society. They're actually up in Boston. They are the largest genealogical society in the country. And they collect, they have many, many, many manuscripts and family histories. If you wanted to go with Family Search, if you wanted to go with another group, I would say make sure you look at the group, how they plan to preserve, like what are their plans for if the technology goes outdated? How are they going to use your records? How are they going to make the records available to other people doing research? But for in terms of your records, I think scanning them is great. Just keep up the technology so it doesn't go out of date and to where you can't use it. But if you're going to use a professional organization, make sure that their values align with yours and that you're happy for them to have your information.
Chris, thanks a lot for that one. By the way, when I was looking at the 1950 census before the show, at the bottom, when you do a search and you put the enumeration district in and everything, and then you put a name in, at the bottom it says AI-generated hits, basically. So artificial intelligence definitely wending its way into what you do as well.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of the search engines are, it's sort of intelligent searching, trying to match names. It's not just You know, it's why a lot of times when you go into a search, it will match, you know, like, say, for example, Tracy Scrabbit, but then it'll say, like, the name, that then you'll go further down and the name is spelled differently, or, and then all of a sudden the first name is different, but the last name is similar. It's because the program behind the scenes is trying to give you, it's trying to go from exact down to broad.
Yeah.
But it has to make choices about how am I going to filter the information.
And then what I found interesting about the AI aspect of this is I was seeing a page that was scrawled by someone who was not, you know, they talk about doctor's handwriting. This was worse. I don't even understand how the computer could make any sense of that, but it did. So it was really cool. All right, let's grab another call here. Tracy Scrabbit is our guest. It's Genealogy. Emily in Nassau, you're on.
Oh, hello. Yes. My mother was born in Italy in 1911. She came to this country when she was 18. Her father had been here already working. Okay. Maybe about, I don't know, 12 years ago, I went down to the consulate in New York, the Italian consulate, with all the papers I had. And one of them was in Italian. And I said, I'd like to apply for dual citizenship. The consulate representative at the consulate looked at the papers and said, your mother was not an Italian citizen. Well, I said, well, how is that possible? She was born there. He said, this document, your grandfather arranged that whenever one of his children was born, they would automatically be born American citizens. I had never heard of that. So I have two questions. Number one, does that sound possible to you? And number two, if it is possible, in the early 60s, I remember we were living up in Essex County. My mother was practicing for a naturalization test. She went up to Plattsburgh. Okay. So if she was indeed born an American citizen, why would she then have to be naturalized? So I'm wondering if I was told the right information.
All right, we only have about 45 seconds. Go ahead, Tracy.
I would say it really would depend on the naturalization laws at the time. That's something I think you would have to check with U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service. Generally, if people were born out of the country, even if the parent was a citizen, they were not automatically granted citizenship. So that's something that they would have had to arrange with the State Department or with U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service. So you would have to check those records to see.
All right, Emily, thanks a lot. We'll have to leave it there. By the way, we got a very nice email from Tom Ruler, who is New York State Archivist, and says you go to www.archivists.org. That's archivists, plural, to learn how to become an archivist. So that's pretty cool. Tracy Scrabbit, you've done it again. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm always happy to be here.
And we'll see you again in, what, about 6 months or so?
Yeah, about right. 6 months.
Excellent. Support comes from the Hyde Collection in Glens Falls, announcing live cinema events with National Theater Live and great art on screen. HydeCollection.org to learn more. And Studio KTM Hair Salon, welcoming Jake Dingler, direct from New York City, joining Kristen Marquette for private one-client in-salon appointments, studioktm.com. Once again, thanks to Tracy Scrabbit for schlepping all the way here from the coast and answering questions. Always fun. Thanks for your questions and thanks for your emails. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our intrepid engineer. Phone screen today by Ed Rosen. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, my gosh, we have a chance for two interesting shows in a row. Jim Hendler and Bob Griffin will be here to talk about cybersecurity and take your questions. That's tomorrow at 2. Stand by now for the book show.